Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Marketplace Discussions podcast. My name is Mahmoud Resmi, and today's guest is Hassan Osman. Hassan is a creator on the side who managed to build a portfolio of side hustles in addition to his full-time job. He is Senior Vice President at NWN Carousel, where he leads the organization's professional services team. And his portfolio includes books, online courses, and a podcast. He is author of several Amazon bestsellers, including Influencing Virtual Teams, Don't Reply All, and most recently, ChatGPT for Nonfiction Authors. His podcast, Writer on the Side, helps full-time employees write and publish their nonfiction books. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you have any questions or any comments, please feel free to leave them in the comments section below if you're on YouTube, or you can reach out to me at DecafQuest on Twitter. Thank you very much for joining me today and for accepting the invitation to join the Marketplace Discussions podcast. I'm really super excited about this one. And I'll jump right into it with just tell us about yourself a little bit.
Yeah. So, where do I start? Tell me about myself. So I have a full day job or full time job. Right now, I am a senior vice president of professional services at a company called NWN Carousel, which focuses on hybrid work for companies. And I always have to say this, whether I'm employed or not, is that views are my own, not those of my employer. And I recently started this job, so it's just been a couple of weeks here, but in my free time, whether it's weeknights or weekends, my to-do or thing that I enjoy doing is writing books and publishing courses on the side. And I've been doing this for quite a while. Started out with my first job. I was in consulting. It's EY. Back then, it was Ernst & Young. And then for 12 years at Cisco Systems, I kept sort of doing writing books and publishing courses while running a full-time demanding job and having a family. So I'm married, I've got two little girls as well. So that's sort of it in a nutshell.
And this is, there are so many reasons why I reached out and I'll let you talk about the story as well, because you might want to mention it. But then, and also congratulations on your new job. And this is why, thank you very much for agreeing to do this, because I understand things might be hectic, perhaps new job, new role, etc. So yeah, thank you again for agreeing to do this. But yeah, we our point of connection, and let's start with this one, is Daniel Vassallo, because how did we come to know each other?
Well, I think I found out about you through him. So I'm a huge fan of his and I follow him closely. And I think this was...
Since when have you been following him, by the way?
Since early 2020, actually. Okay. Maybe a little bit before that. But the reason why I bring this up is because in early 2020, this was before COVID, like literally the first couple of months, he had published his book and it was doing crazy numbers. So I reached out to him and I said, would you like to be on my podcast? And in February, he kindly agreed to be on my podcast and we ended up talking. But Daniel basically tweeted that he was going to join one of your cohort-based courses about philosophy. It was specifically, I think it was called The Philosophy of Money. I think that's how it was called, right? And first of all, I found the topic fascinating. Second of all, I clicked through and I read about you and your background. And I think we shared a little bit of that sort of Lebanese heritage background there. So I was like, I'm in. You know, you got the endorsement of Daniel. And he was going to be in that course, that cohort-based course. I ended up watching it, which, and I'm sure I shared this with you, but it was amazing. It was really eye-opening for me. Learned a lot. I'm not that into philosophy, but I'm very curious by nature. And even though I knew going into that course, we're not going to get any answers, but it's just that sort of gray matter stimulation through thinking was great. So that's how we met. And since then, I think we've been following each other on Twitter and some overlap there with the small bets community of Daniel, which is amazing.
Yeah, indeed. And yeah, thank you for also signing up for the course. It was particularly a difficult one for many reasons. But yeah, it's the kind of stuff that I do is maybe I'm going to be asking you about this later during our conversation. But then you're not that much into philosophy. I will also ask you about this. but in any case, yeah, so we haven't ever met, but then it's because of that you even saw that I taught at AUB. You're like, yeah, that's it, AUB. And yeah. Free books for all your students. And so you were willing to help. Thank you very much. Again, this was nice. And particularly, I would like to know a little bit more about your background. I know you grew up in the UAE. You went to Lebanon for your undergrad. Yes. Tell us a little bit about your
Sure. So my parents are Lebanese, both of them, and I was born in Beirut, in sort of the middle of the civil war back then. And my parents, specifically my father, just fleeing the country because of what was going on. He went to the UAE, specifically Abu Dhabi, and he started his own business. He was an architect. You know, the country back then was like a desert, literally, and started just getting projects. And we fled the civil war. So I grew up there. I grew up in the UAE. Most people know Dubai. Not a lot of people know that Abu Dhabi is the capital. So Dubai is one of the biggest cities, obviously, in the UAE. So grew up there, and then a year before graduating high school, we moved to Lebanon. I went to International College. It's not a college, it's actually a high school, but it's sort of a misnomer there with the name. I did a last year of high school there, graduated, and then I entered AUB as a freshman. A year doing that, and then going into engineering. I did civil engineering. Well, I started out in architecture, then shifted into civil engineering, and then came to the US after graduation.
You went back to Lebanon. Do you remember the year? So that would be if we're...
I remember exactly. Late... Yeah, 1995. Yep. So we moved to Lebanon in 95, did a year there of high school. I entered AUB in 1996.
How was the experience?
It was a culture shock.
Like some sort of culture shock, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From going... So Lebanon, as you probably know, is one of the more liberal countries in that region, right? In terms of, you know, the Gulf and all of that. And I remember it was definitely a little bit of a culture shock coming in from a conservative country and then moving into a country which was very open in terms of ideas, in terms of diversity too. So the school I went to, International College, or IC for short, was also an international American school, or it was sort of an American system. So you have a lot of expats too. So you're not only getting the culture shock of Lebanon and Beirut in particular, but you're also getting the imported cultural sort of shock from others that have moved to the country. And that experience moved with me into freshman. So when I went into AUB, the American University of Beirut, AUB, as you know, is one of the better schools in the region, not just in Lebanon. And so you also get this magnet of thoughts and diversity and different ways of thinking from the countries around it. I mean, I even had a couple of American friends in the American University of Beirut when I was starting out. So it was a little bit of a shock. It was a little bit of an eye opener for sure.
For those wondering why I'm asking about this, well, because I taught at AUB for 5 or 6 years, and I would usually get Lebanese students who grew up in the UAE and other Gulf countries, and they would experience this culture shock. So when I taught freshmen, they would be one like they it showed on their faces that they were kind of disoriented. Like where? So add all these experiences together. I usually understood the students and we would spend, as I told you before, like an entire session just discussing these differences, the culture shocks, but not only in terms of culture and meeting people from all over the world from different backgrounds, etc. Because maybe Abu Dhabi in the 80s was a bit different, but like now students 2010, 2007, they were already exposed to different cultures, but coming to Beirut, it was a whole new experience to them.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, one thing to add, keep in mind back then, internet was almost not existent.
Exactly.
Right? So I mean, even today, even if you live in a particular country and you don't travel at all, just the exposure you get through your smartphone is gonna mitigate that cultural shock by leaps.
Oh, believe me. Despite that, I think it's because it can give you a distorted image, perhaps, because they come to Beirut, maybe they have one particular idea in mind, and then they live, and it's a completely different experience. Not a bad one. It's just a
different
ways of doing things, right? And add to it, in my case, it's a philosophy course. So they're like, what the hell are we doing here? Why? Many of them, nowadays, it depends also on the country, but many of them hadn't even learned philosophy before or taken any courses. Have you taken any? I assume liberal arts, you had to take a few cultural studies.
I did in freshman. So, you know, the program, usually you've got a few electives, and I did select one philosophy course. Actually, it wasn't a general philosophy course. It was a logic course. So that's the pragmatic side of philosophy. I wish I did end up taking, I mean, there was even a course which was quite controversial about the existence of God. I remember that was given at AUB, and this was, you know, talking about culture shock, right? Like, religion is something you don't talk about a lot, or at least you don't challenge a lot in some countries, but with Lebanon, everything's on the table. Yeah, you can talk about it. So, and it was from the perspective of different religions. It wasn't like focusing on Christianity or Islam or Druze, or, I mean, it was just everything, just the idea of, does God exist or not? I didn't take that course, but I had friends who did, and it was just very interesting discussions we'd have on the West Hall side and the Green Oval.
Typical AU bite. Oh,
yes.
As an engineering student, yeah, but we'll get into more, yeah, the inner AUB jokes. But any other cultural studies courses where you required to take any of them? Not necessarily philosophy, but, you know, CVSP 1, 2, 3, cultural studies.
Yes, we did take CS, I think it was called CS 101, cultural studies 101. And then there was one about the, I think it was like the history of art. And then there was one about Stephen Hawking's, like the black hole.
Yeah.
I mean,
you did take the CS.
Yeah, a couple of them.
Anything stuck with you? I'm getting somewhere eventually with this, but yeah. Honestly speaking, as an engineering student, you were just in it for the grade because you had to, or what was your experience?
Yeah.
Your perspective.
Look, I maybe the best way to help explain this is to just fast forward a little bit into what happened after, and then I'll go back to this. So
after I
graduated from freshman in AUB, I applied to the architecture school, which was very, very competitive. And the only reason why I applied to that was because my father's an architect, and just the typical Lebanese mentality, and the eldest son, I end up taking over the family business and all of that, right? I started architecture. It was horrible. I got accepted, which was amazing. It made my father happy. It made, you know, the greater family happy. But I was miserable because architecture, first of all, is super competitive, specifically in Lebanon. I remember the first day, he was a professor from MIT, Lebanese, and he goes, look, there's only so much architects in the world. This is a 5-year program. Nearly 95% of you will have to repeat at least 1 year out of those 5 years. It was just like insane, you know? And I'll get to some interesting stories about this at some later point in time. But I ended up dropping out of architecture and I shifted to civil engineering because that's the closest thing to architecture with the family business. But I felt more at home because it was more logical. It was more 1+1=2. I didn't have to be thinking outside the box from an artistic standpoint. I didn't have that creativity. So let's rewind back to your question about did anything stick with me and whether I did those because I had to or whether I did them because I wanted to. And the answer is it's because I had to and not a lot stuck, to be honest with you. Something did stick with a philosophy course that focused on the logic components. That to me was extremely helpful because it gave me a tool set that I can use from a pragmatic standpoint. So, we talk left brain, right brains. I'm very, very much left brained in the sense that in my mind, I have to think in terms of sequential steps. I feel like you're going to challenge me on this and I'm
no, not at all. Challenge in the sense that for a left brained person, you're quite creative with your side hustles.
Well, I appreciate that vote of confidence, but I can't be creative in the sense that I don't know if I've got that artistic, philosophical, think outside the box type personality.
I have to disagree with this one. I think you were thinking outside the box way before any of us was, and we'll get into
this. I'm sure we'll talk about that.
Shortly, because don't try to convince me otherwise. I think what's going on here is this is the romantic idea of where we're creative, and I understand an architect. You know, you need to have a feeling for design and stuff like that, and In that case, it's not necessarily thinking outside the box. We can give Zaha Hadid as an example, but it does take a different kind of interest. So yeah. Let's say maybe you were not interested, as simple as that.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. Yeah, and I know that...
Because electrical engineering also is quite logical on the one hand, but then, I mean... You do have to think outside the box as well.
True. With engineering, you absolutely do. It was civil, not electrical, but
civil.
That's okay. I think even internally, everyone got confused about what they were studying, especially those who weren't that interested in it. But
civil, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. So I ended up even third year into engineering, I felt like this is not where my passion is, and I ended up shifting into IT mainly. Like that was, I felt like this is what I want to do. So immediately after graduation, I applied to graduate school here in the US and I shifted my focus from engineering into information technology.
Oh, so your EY days were after your graduate studies?
Yes, it was after I graduated with a master's degree.
Oh, and the master's degree, you got it from?
Carnegie Mellon University, which is in Pittsburgh, and that was in information security policy and management. And yeah.
So the first job you got at EY, where was that?
It was in Detroit. It was in the U.S. Yeah. I did not work so in.
Okay. Yeah. I thought because this is a somewhat of a cognitive dissonance for me in terms of in my mind. AUB students, EY, so they graduate, they go to Abu Dhabi, Dubai, work in consulting, and then afterwards they do their masters, and then afterwards they move abroad or something. Your story is different. Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. It was just so only the undergrad part was in Lebanon, but then when I graduated, I moved directly to the US, did my masters, and started work here.
Yeah. So the before I ask you about the work in at EY or Detroit in this case, and in IT, which I know absolutely nothing about. So you'll tell me. But also, yeah, this is the thing. You have zero creativity, you said, or something. You're not that good in that department. But you, at least, this was on your LinkedIn. I never saw that anywhere. Like this was there.
Sure.
Photojournalism publishing company.
Yes. Oh wow. You're This podcast interview feels like a little bit of therapy. You're taking me back a few years deep down. Yes. So this was actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because when I was working at EY, I took an unpaid leave of absence, actually. And I worked on a magazine. I started it on the side a little bit, and then I wanted to do it like for 6 months without getting paid. It was a financial disaster. Let's start there. It was it did not do well, but it was a lot of fun. So what I did was, it's a photojournalism magazine. For those who don't know, photojournalism, what differentiates it from photography is that photography focuses on the art. Photojournalism focuses on photos with a story. So it's like you're telling a story through pictures. And, you know, the best type of stories that you get are like usually like war photography, right? Like what's going on in a particular war zone, and you kind of show what's going on there. Or it could be just what's called a photo essay, a series of photos. And some of the biggest magazines at the time, National Geographic, Time Magazine, those big ones, I'd ask a lot of people, like, do you read those? Like, whenever you're there, they'd be like, we just look at the pictures. We just flip them. You know, you're waiting at the barbershop or whatever, and you enjoy seeing all those pictures that are like the full spread of the magazine with a little bit of text explaining what's going on and like a series of 7 or 8 photos. So I was like, why not create a magazine that only focuses on that? Like, I don't want the, you know, 15 pages of articles and analysis. I'll just choose maybe 3 or 4 stories and talk about a particular theme, right? And the idea was to have this as a ad-supported magazine. So I started out with this idea of, okay, we'll get some sponsors, and then we'll publish the magazine, but then we'll give it away for free, at least initially. So the first maybe 3 or 4 issues were given away for free in Lebanon to kind of help spread the word and word of mouth and all of that. And then we shifted it into a paid product. So yeah, and it did maybe, I think, 8-10 issues. And then it was like, I can't sustain it. Like I went in naively thinking it's going to be able to make some money and sustain the heavy cost of printing, but
and it didn't. You were running it from the US. You took a leave of absence, but you were...
I moved to Lebanon for like 6 months.
Oh, you moved?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to try out.
So
like
you
an
wanted in Lebanon with what was it called?
It was called Suwar, which means Suwar. Photographs or pictures in Arabic. Suwar magazine.
Okay. Yeah, that's quite interesting indeed. And yeah, I saw like you printed 10,000 copies. At least this is, yeah.
Yeah.
How did you, just like briefly, because I'm this is, if this is not thinking outside the box, even if it was a failure, right? You learned a few things. Maybe let's start with this. What did you learn from this venture?
Yeah, great question. First of all, that you probably should minimize the risks that you take with a lot of those things, right? So I did not do enough due diligence about the actual market of whether sponsors actually pay for this, or they pay the market rate of an ad. They usually heavily discount it. So that was a little bit off. Second is what I didn't know, and I'm sure you know this, is that in Lebanon, business is not done on merit or ideas. It is done based on relationships. And I had none. Like naively going up to like some of the big brands saying, hey, I've got this amazing magazine. Would you like to be a sponsor? And it's like, who the heck is this guy? Like, are you seriously just walking into the door expecting business? So you know, that's a few things that I miscalculated. I think I was passionate about the project. I still think it's just an amazing thing. You know, just like you've got coffee table books that people sell hundreds of millions of, and they enjoy flipping through them. So there's a viable customer for that. And we did get a lot of interest. But I think the biggest shock for me, and I lost some money because the cost of printing is a lot. And when I'm giving it out for free, it's not, you know, it's not negligible. So I learned that I need to think a little bit differently about ROI and investing and taking risks. going forward.
And the pictures you were, so you were just asking other photographers to bring in their stories, or how was it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually reached out to established photojournalists, okay. is what they're called, at AFP, Reuters, and a lot of freelancers. One of them was Bill Foley, who got the Pulitzer Award for Sabra and Shatila, that massacre. And we actually, I published his photos in the magazine back then. So some really amazing photography, like really, really well-known people. And it was hard because I had to convince them to put this in for free because the magazine wasn't making money, right? But it was great marketing for them because they're the owner of the copyright and they get a lot of interest in their work and followers and so on and so forth. So I had to, you know, play the convincing game of going to sponsors, trying to get funding, and then photojournalists to get their photos and then be the middle person on all of that.
Why did you take that kind of plunge? Because how many years after you started your first job was this?
Two and a half years.
So what was the thought process? Because this might tie with what we're going to be discussing about your side hustles.
It was a purely entrepreneurial move with a passion for the subject. So it was sort of, you know, if I want to do things on my own, how would that look like? I wanted to kind of learn about this field and industry. And plus, I was really enjoying those photo essays. Like it was, you know, like a little bit of a passion project. So a combination of some of those. I knew I was young. I didn't have kids. I think I was engaged at the time. But I did not, I was married actually, but so it was easier to take risks before you had, you know, building a family. And that was sort of like a little bit of a shot, on that. So a little bit of a calculation. Plus I had the backup of a job, like the job was there. You know, at the time I also wanted to see if I can help my family too, going through some rough times. So it was like a combination of that, starting a business, family oriented, a little bit of that passion. Project, and I still had a way back into my full-time job. So worst case is I lose a bunch of money, but I have some stability.
Typical follow your passion. I want to do this, so you quit your job, and this is what characterizes you. Like you built an entire brand, kind of on the side guy, kind of. Right. In addition to your full-time job. You have, so far that I know of, written books on the side. You've done courses on the side. You do a podcast on the side as well. And am I forgetting anything?
No, that's pretty much it. And a couple of blogs. So along with the podcast, it's sort of, I sometimes blog on that. And then with another blog called The Couch Manager, which is similar to the books and courses that I teach, but it's also a blog that I keep up. But yeah, you pretty much summed it up.
So tell us about this. First off, the question would be maybe has two sides to it. On the one hand, did your venture into this photojournalism kind of field get you to rethink about things? Like, okay, I want to do something on the side, but let me explore how, why, and what was it like to start? What even got you to start thinking about, I want to do other stuff? Like many people, and we discussed the freelance mindset in a previous episode. So what many people just enjoy their full-time job. Right. They enjoy the security, everything. They're like, okay, I got it sorted out. Why should I worry about other things? So
excellent question. Look, in fact, before the magazine, I wrote my first book in 2006, 2007. So day
one. I saw that, by the way.
Yeah. the first day of my first job at EY. I remember going into the office in Michigan and finishing up all my orientation. I got my new laptop and all of that. I went back home and then I opened my personal laptop and I start writing the first few words of my first book. So literally, this is, I remember it very clearly, like the exact same first day. So
what how do I called? Answer this?
It was called Securing Your Information in an Insecure World. So my master's degree was in information security, which for those who are listening, it's basically how to protect your information from hackers, right? Like that's the degree I did, but it was focused specifically on the management of it, not so much on the technical side. And my job at Ernst & back then it was called Ernst & Young, now they rebranded to EY. It was a consultant in that space. So it was fairly a hot topic and I did a master's degree in it. I was part of the first batch of graduating students of that program. So that's how new it was. And then I went into a consulting arm of EY that focused on that. So I was like, I'm getting a lot of questions. People are asking me to explain things in a basic way. So I was like, I have to write something to put that out there because one, I can leverage the credibility that I got from my master's degree. I can leverage the credibility that I have in my full-time job doing this for big companies. And it's just a natural way to progress. Now, you asked me why did I start with that? And I think the answer, I've been trying to write a blog post or a podcast episode or to talk through a podcast episode answering this question, like, why do I do things on the side? And I'm still struggling with it, to be fully honest with you, but I think it can be boiled down to carrots and sticks. And what I mean by that is, in management, carrots are things that motivate you because of some sort of positive reward, right? It's just like a, you know, a bonus or some sort of reward. And then with a stick, it's a negative consequence. So if you do XYZ and it's not up to standards, then you're on a performance improvement plan or you get fired or you get disciplined in some way, right? So I'm talking here not from a management standpoint, I'm talking just as an internal struggle or motivating factors. And I think there it's a combination of both that kind of dance together fairly gracefully. And what I mean by that is carrots, because it's I genuinely enjoy the process of teaching, whether it's through writing or teaching on, you know, online courses or having conversations. I don't have any tattoos and I don't judge anyone for not for having them. But if I were to ever get one, and I always say this, it would be the phrase ancora imparo. And ancora imparo is a Latin phrase or an Italian phrase, depending on how you want to look at it. That means yet I am still learning or still I am learning, depending on how you want to translate it. And it's famous because Michelangelo, the quintessential Renaissance man, said it at the ripe age of 87. I think with everything he accomplished, you go, you know, ancora imparo, like yet I still learn. And it's like, I think this constant quest for learning of curiosity and, you know, trying out new different things. I think that's a main driver behind what I do, right? Like that's a carrot for me. Now the money is good. Like that's, it's not, I'm not going to dismiss the fact that having another stream another income stream is fantastic, right? Like you can buy things with them. You can have that additional security blanket. And it is a driver. Like that's part of the carrot, but the primary one is really this quest for learning. And I think in my own weird mind, I just get very, very bored very quickly. So like if I'm just doing one thing over and over and I don't have that switch to do something else that's mentally stimulating, I think I just phase out, right? So that's the carrot part. And then the stick part is this fear of losing potentially a job, right? That at any point in time, my job is not guaranteed. There's this famous book called The Startup of You. It's written by Ben Casnocha and Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman was the co-founder of LinkedIn. And the premise of the book is that you should treat your brand or your what you do as a startup. Like literally, you are as a startup, not just as an individual. And one statement they highlight in the book is this billboard that they read on a highway in California that said, a million people overseas can do your job. What makes you so special? And that stuck with me. It's like, you know, it's a wake-up call that everyone is dispensable, no matter how skilled you are. And so there's the fear factor of, I need to keep my skills sharp. I need to understand how to build a business, how to have some sort of, you know, transferable skills that I can use in another business or another venture or something else. So I know it's a philosophical answer in a way, but that sort of carrot and stick dynamic is still to this day in the back of my mind.
This is a very interesting answer, and for now that's the only word I can think of. It is philosophical indeed, and there's so much to unpack there, which is, so we can take this anywhere you want, right? Because on the one hand, it's this, as you said, the mentioning the skills is quite interesting, because you got me thinking about myself here. It's quite, yeah, I need to see how to focus on this in this case. In my case, I never actually got a full-time position as a professor. I was always on a part-time basis. So I was the risk of losing a job or a stream and an income stream was always there, right? Maybe yeah. This is because I come from a philosophy background. So you are more of a philosophy guy than myself, definitely, because you thought about this. You thought this through. I never, not never. It's maybe it was because I was busy trying to maintain income streams, and this is why yeah. I was not able to, or I never really thought about the fact that I needed to hone my skills or develop new skills.
Yeah, yeah, understood.
So this is, it's quite interesting, because for some reason, when it comes, and the freelance mindset, again, the book is really good. I keep going back to it. How important is it to develop skills? Like, what kind of, start with a zero. Like, what kind of skills should we develop to begin with? And why is that important for us to kind of keep on going and keep on learning?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I remember same book, Startup of You, they talk about this concept of permanent beta. Permanent, so the concept of beta in the software world is that the software is not ready for release yet. It's not perfect. It still has a lot of bugs in it. And you need to improve upon it before you get to the alpha version of it, right? And the idea is to stay in permanent beta. A simple example of this is, to some people, 15 years of experience is 1 year of experience repeated 15 times. Whereas to other people, 15 years of experience is 15 years of experience, right? So the premise behind why should we keep our skill sets sharp, I think at the fundamental level, and it's like I'm talking to a PhD in philosophy here, so
I'm learning from you, man. it's the you should have the PhD in philosophy. I should be just out there trying to learn new skills.
This is the engineer talking. So I think fundamentally it is about survival. Like, I think it's as simple as that. I think our brains are wired with everything that we do, like that fundamental root foundation of everything we do, even us talking today, you know, building a friendship, a relationship, it's about survival, like at the tribal level, like, right? Like we become friends. If someone comes over a hill, we get to fight them, like, because they're the enemy, right? Like that's sort of a way that I think about it. And so, if you ask me what is the drive for a skill set, I'll go back to the stick, which is, look, if you're not ready and this blow happens, even though surprisingly I've never been in a position where I got laid off, I've seen it happen. I've seen it, you know, through you, for example. I've seen it through a few others where it's you know, the risk is there. And maybe that's why I've been a little bit too analytical about this, is that mathematically I'm just a statistic, and at any point in time I can be dropped. And so that's the fear factor of not being able to survive. And so what skills do I need to be able to build some sort of a viable business or some transferable skills, where if I get the call tomorrow that my job is no longer there, I am able to survive, forget, you know, becoming a multimillionaire, just be able to survive with the skill set that I have, coupled with the fact that I had a failure with my magazine, because that was like, I poured a lot of money and I didn't see anything back. Now it's like, okay, I can take more calculated risks where the only big investment is my time. And even if it's a little bit of money, but I still have that cash flow coming in. So instead of spending most of the time on Netflix, or back then it was Blockbuster, or even, you know, family and friend dinners every single day, I'll take a couple of those days and that evening build something that I can rely on if I fall back. Now, again, survival as a driver, but it's not only that. I have to make this so clear to your listeners, because it is not just fear-driven. I think if it was only fear-driven, I wouldn't have survived. The carrot part is so important. Like, it was therapeutic for me, like sitting down and just, you know, typing and writing and teaching and getting the feedback, you know, with the blog initially, was great. So it is that dual pronged, like that dichotomy is I think what drove me for sure.
Interesting. It's like some sort of self-fulfillment on the one hand. See, this is the thing. You're creating, you're building on the side. This is quite artistic, even if it's not artistic in the artsy, fartsy sense.
Yeah, kind of, I know what you mean.
And you're building, and on the other hand, you're developing your skills. And again, I think this is what happened. In my case, the 7 years of experience in academia was not really just, you know, the same thing time and again, but I was cocooned somehow within this institution. I learned much more when I left academia, because I was fending for myself now, but in a different way. Because I always knew, well, I'll get a course here, I'll get a gig here, it's okay. And you keep talking to yourself or convincing yourself, yeah, why? Or, you know, it's gonna be okay. But then when you're out there, yeah, you'll have to really survive, and then you get all the creative juices kind of running, and things take a different shape. So is this why? And maybe you can walk us through your books, and you can talk about anything you want with this question. But is this why you jumped on the AI trend now? Because you recently published a book about how to use GPT. It was co-authored with ChatGPT. So is this why you did this, as part of, you know, honing your skills and then jumping on a trend? Or
great question. Look, so maybe just for context for those who are listening, because I've written 17 books so far, the first 16, and I don't mean
my
this to be
God,
boastful.
Man.
It's just, and by the way, just to clarify, they're very short books, right?
So extremely. So I bought three. I think I bought the email one, I bought the AI one, and
mental models. I remember you.
Mental models.
Yes. Right. Thank you, and I appreciate your support.
And this is very short, and I read them all.
Thank you.
Cover to cover. So
so when I say 17, it sounds like I'm this, you know, insane machine, but it's not. It's not as hard as people think it takes. But and I have a certain philosophy about writing, and maybe we'll get into that before we get into the AI book, because that was an anomaly, just to kind of start with that, right? So my philosophy about writing books is, like, when I want to choose a topic, I think about three intersecting circles. Think of a Venn diagram, right? Those three circles are interest, experience, and market. So meaning something you're interested in, you don't have to be extremely passionate about it, but you're interested in this topic, right? You might be interested in philosophy, that's your thing. Experience, so meaning having some sort of experience in that domain because of credibility, because of, you know, you already kind of are in that space. And then the third circle is market, meaning there's an active buy-sell market about this topic. People underestimate the importance of that, and there are methods to kind of look at it, but the intersection of those three, something you're interested in, something you have experience in, and something that has an active buy sell market, is where I usually focus, right? And there are a couple of other optional circles. One is job related, meaning the topic is kind of related to your job. If you're a full-time employee or an entrepreneur, it could work either way. And then another is being an evergreen topic, but just because you want the, you know, it might get popular in a couple of years and you want to take advantage of the long-term effects as opposed to the short-term ones. So those are usually my criteria, right? This doesn't always happen with me sitting down and writing, oh, it has to be, you know, check the box as a checklist. It kind of happens organically. But when I kind of talk about how to write a book and all of that, I at least try to guide people towards that, because if you miss one of them, there's usually repercussions. It's not always the case. There are exceptions, but if you're writing about something you're not interested in, it's going to show in your writing. For example, if there's no active buy sell market, it's more of a passion project than an actual viable book, right? So there's that. And so my books have been focused on short books for busy managers. So because I've been at Cisco leading, and before that consulting with EY, a lot of the books that I've written, like the one you mentioned about emails, how to communicate better through emails, also about virtual teams. I've been working from home for a while, and how do you work with people you don't see? How do you manage them? So I wrote a book about that because it was something I was doing organically. So all those books have been focused a little bit on that. Now, I did write in different categories and genres, which we'll talk about here in a second, but that was like my main fundamental book writing category, short books for busy managers. In December of 2022, when I was writing my next book, it was a book about how to present to business executives. So that's usually a big issue in corporate America, where people walk into an executive, you know, they think they have 30 minutes, they end up having seven, and it's like you're all over the place. So what do you focus on? So it was like literally structuring how to present to an executive leader. And ChatGPT came out, the AI large language model. And I was curious. So I wanted to learn how to use that and see how I can leverage ChatGPT to help me write the book about presenting to executives. I started using it, Mahmoud, and I felt like I need to stop because this is just insane. And I'm going to pivot to how ChatGPT can help authors write their own books. So, and I said, you know, I'll have ChatGPT help me write it, right? So I paused writing the book about presenting to executives, and I spent, this was during Christmas break, so we're off on vacation. And it literally took me just 1 week end to end to sit down and write a full book about, and it's called ChatGPT for Nonfiction Authors. It did really well. It's still a number one bestseller. It's selling around 30 to 50 copies a day. I did it for charity. It's, you know, 99 cents. You can go check it out. You know, all the proceeds go to charity, because I felt kind of guilty that I had ChatGPT do the work. And I was just like the conductor guiding it. But so to your question, this would not have passed my checklist of things to do, because to me, this is not an evergreen topic in the sense that I think it's going to be short-lived because technology advances very quickly. So in a few months, we're going to come up with yet another technology or some version of it where it's going to, you know, cause that book to be obsolete. So I usually wouldn't, but this was an exception just because it was a hot topic. I have my podcast about writing on the side. I write books anyway, and it didn't take me such a long time to publish it. And it was fun. It was fun doing it. Like, I wanted to the point about curiosity, right? It was fun doing it. So I wanted to just do it while enjoying my time. And that's how I published it.
It was quite interesting because while everyone is talking about whether ChatGPT is good or bad, you were there using it. And this is kind of my heuristic, like those who spend their time debating ChatGPT on Twitter, it's like there are those who are talking about it and those who are using it. And it's quite helpful. Like, yeah, I don't understand why people, I understand why the pros and cons and the debates about whether, where this is going, etc. But then if it can be a helpful tool. It's a tool. I mean, yeah. And it's quite interesting. But
I must give you credit for one thing, by the way. I took your guest lecture, speaking of Daniel Vassallo. I know you and I are guest lecturers and as part of his community, and you gave a talk once, which I think you're still giving, right? I believe you're still
June. I'm scheduled for another one. Yeah.
In June. Okay. Wonderful. So it was about Stoicism. And that was honestly, genuinely one of the best talks that I've attended, because it was such a wake-up call about how to view the world. In a way, I felt like I was a stoic without even that label.
You are, yeah.
And maybe, you know, through you, I think you were too kind. You mentioned me on that guest class when I joined. And I think that was a wake-up call to reinforce my outlook on life, in the sense that you gave it a label. And this, you know, any new topic that comes out, I approach it with a very neutral lens. In the sense, like, I don't overreact, like even with NFTs or cryptocurrencies. It's more of this curiosity, just I want to learn a little bit more about what drives people's behavior towards that, right? And I can't relate a lot sometimes with the extreme reactions to either I absolutely love this, is going to change the world, or I'm super indifferent to that. Like, I'm just taking it as it is. And if tomorrow, I'm a fan of ChatGPT today, but if tomorrow you and I have a conversation and we put the business case that it's horrible for society, I'd be like, yeah, I'd buy that. It's horrible for society. Maybe I should, like, I'm yeah. Like, so, and I think that's a stoic sort of, without even knowing that it's a stoic type of way of looking at life. So yeah, like, to me, I just jumped on a trend, not because of an opportunity. It was more of, I'm curious, I want to learn. The best way to learn something is to teach it. And I know how to write books, and I'm just going to go through it, right? So
this is quite interesting, because part of one question I had in mind is this. So I think you started writing books before you started doing the courses, right? Because you also have courses. Correct. That you, okay. Correct. And so what's the process like? Do you do your research, and then based on your experience, you reflect, you iterate, and then you come up with a book? Or is it you do some introspection, you look at how you're dealing with a certain problem, because you mentioned it was questions people were asking you, and you were trying to respond to this kind of problem that you were experiencing or others. What's the process of writing books for you? Is in addition to learning through writing, yeah, and articulating your ideas?
I think the main thing that sparks an idea about a book is what's called scratching your own itch. Like, it's a problem that you face and you want to solve it, and you end up solving it for you, and you feel like this might be helpful for other people to know, right? So one of them was leading virtual teams. It was tough, you know, people you don't see, how do you manage them? How do you build a sense of teamwork, collaboration, and all of that? And people start asking you questions, and you're like, okay, organically, this makes a lot of sense. Email. One of the biggest, you know, second most time waster at work. I used to get 300 emails a day, and it's not the volume that bothered me. It was the quality that bothered me. So it's like, you know, when you write, like, it's not just it's too many emails. It's too many bad emails in team communication, right? I'm not talking about email marketing. This is just, you know, when you're sending me an email, sometimes, not you personally, but like a colleague, it's like seven paragraphs long. And then in the fifth paragraph, third sentence, they have a question. And then there's an action item in the eighth paragraph. Like, point those out up top, right? Like, write a couple of bullet points. Here's what you need, and then add all the additional information below. So few things like that were bothering me personally, that I felt like, okay, if I were to give someone on my team some guidelines, here's a book. And I ended up writing, it's called Don't Reply All. Because that's the pet peeve at organizations, where everyone replies all to everything. So,
oh yeah,
that's how it starts.
Which is quite interesting, because I have two questions here, because I know we're almost on time, and I want to ask these particularly. How did you end up jumping into Udemy? And why did you decide to do these courses? Not why did you decide to choose Udemy in particular, but yeah, why courses asynchronously? Yeah. And what kind of tips would you have to encourage other people to either write a book or do a course on the side?
So to answer the first question about why did I shift to courses, I learned early on that different people consume information in different ways. And I'm the perfect case study of that. Like sometimes I like reading, sometimes I like listening to audiobooks when I'm like driving or at the gym or whatever. And then sometimes I like to sit down and, you know, if I'm having my ice cream or a cup of coffee, I don't want to read. I just want to consume by watching. So early on, just reading a lot of blogs about marketing and all of that, that you should repurpose your content into different formats to get the advantages of the different channels. Same thing, being driven by curiosity for learning. It's like, how do you create a YouTube video? Or how do you create, how do you use Camtasia Studio to edit videos and all of that? And I was like, you know what? I've got a book that was fairly successful. People were interested about that. I've done the hard work on the research. Why just not repackage that into a course? And that's been my philosophy since then. So every book that I've published, I've turned into a course, literally just sort of sometimes even reading off some slides, bullet points that are from the book. And it's so interesting because sometimes courses do way better than books. Sometimes books do way better than courses. But to me, it's like minimal effort to maximum return, because the hardest part is the research and the actual content of it. And I've been lucky because I started out with Udemy early on. I'm up to like 200 and I think like 90,000 students now on Udemy.
That's which is a huge number, man.
I still pinch
more
myself
than what
on
a
it.
Professor would teach us in 20 lifetimes or even more. The 500.
It is insane.
Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate. Like, I don't know. You know, sometimes it's just a factor of timing. Like it was early in the Udemy days where I started publishing those courses on them.
So when was the first course that you launched?
End of 2013.
13.
So it's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while.
And success-wise, when did you see this shift? Like when did your courses start maybe selling more?
The tipping point for courses and books was the pandemic. Because my books and courses were about how to communicate and how to lead remotely. And so people were new to this whole field. I mean, not everyone. A lot of people in tech, this was, you know, a regular Tuesday for them. But for a lot of people who'd never worked on Zoom or on WebEx or Microsoft Teams, this was completely new. And then they wanted to know, what are some of the techniques? So in a way, I was kind of, you know, ready for that moment. My courses and my books already were fairly highly reviewed on Udemy and Amazon. And so natural, organic, like I'll give you numbers. My Influencing Virtual Teams book, 1 month before the pandemic, I think was making maybe $200, $300 a month. When the pandemic hit, it went up to like $2,000. That didn't last for a very long time, but it was like 2,000, 1,900, 2,100, like just for, and this was nearly zero marketing. In fact, I was asked to be on a lot of conferences and all of that, and I did all of that for free. So I was really kind of just, you know, trying to help everyone I can, schools, nonprofits, just giving them insights into how to lead remotely. So I think that was a huge tipping point for me overall. And, you know, I've been fortunate that the some of those have been cross-marketed just based on the algorithm.
This adaptation is a skill that is quite important as well. This developing curiosity, adapting, because I remember back in the day, like when we first started doing things on WebEx, I think it was, some professors were like, nope, I'm not gonna do that. The stubbornness. Yeah. When it comes to tips, I know Mark yes. Baker, Guru Anaerobic, is going to be listening to this one because of
well, that was going to be a question. I was going to ask you.
So yeah,
I do.
Sorry, Mark, you have to wait till I don't know, an hour into the discussion. But yes,
he can fast forward, I think, up until the end and then go back.
But, I'll mark it for him.
And I'll explain what we're talking about here for those who probably don't know what we're talking about. But in terms of tips, like this might be a little bit self-serving, but I think the best thing to do, because of the limited time we have here, is I published a book out of those 17 called Write Your Book on the Side. It is a book that explains in very simple step-by-step instructions how to go from knowing nothing about writing a book all the way to potentially even launching a bestseller on Amazon. The book has done fairly well. There are over 600 reviews on Amazon. And wow. I know this sounds self-serving, but it is 100% free. So the book right now is permanently free on Amazon. It is also permanently free on Gumroad. So if you want to go to writerontheside.com, click on that first link you see on the page and download it. It's again, it's like a lot of people have read it, came back to me and said, I just got my first book published, which makes me super happy. I'm very fortunate. I don't need the cash from this, but it's honestly written because I got those questions all the time. It was like, you know what? Everyone is asking me, how do you write on the side while having a family, while having a full-time job? And then you keep just pumping those. And it's everything. Like everything is in that book. And I've updated it a couple of times. So that would be tip number one, the big one. But then if I'll give you a philosophical answer and then we'll jump into Guru Anaerobic's question. If you are thinking about writing a book, then don't. And what I mean by that is, this isn't my phrase. I stole it, I think, from Tim Ferriss, said it at one point. And what I mean by that, he meant by that, is that if you were really passionate about writing a book, you would have already started. So if you've been thinking about it for 3 years or 4 years, then just don't do it. Like, and honestly, that's just going to be liberating for some people because you don't want it looming over your head. Now, if the question is, how do I get started, or self-publishing versus traditional publishing, those are valid questions. And nearly every single answer is in that book. And my top tip would be just start. Like, don't overthink it. Just get a Microsoft Word or Google Doc and just start writing. Just literally sit down and start writing 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and you'll eventually get it done. Now I want to pivot a question I should ask you, because on Twitter, before we jumped on this call here, I did say I'm jumping on a call with Mahmoud. And are there any questions you'd like me to ask him? And Guru Anaerobic, Mark, actually asked if I could ask you, how does it feel, or what does it feel like living under a bridge? So maybe tell people, first of all, where that comes from.
Yeah.
Living under a bridge. And
and then I'll respond to this and then ask you maybe the last question, which is about also the courses in addition to the Write on the Side, like maybe tips about, I don't know, whatever, anything related to the courses, because this is also why Mark was, or he's going to be doing a course because on Udemy, because of you. So you're not influencing 300,000 people, and Mark in this case. But how the bridge, see, this is a thing when it comes, I've rebranded myself so many times over the past 3 years as part of survival of the fittest, but not intentionally. At first I was unemployable for some time. This was inspired by Mark Baker, Guru Anaerobic, on Twitter, because I read his Gang Fit book, the first two.
They're great books, by the way. I love his style.
And fourth, yeah, they're it's all based on experience responding to problems, just like you said. And I think he can do a good job in this case. But so unemployable, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I moved back to Salamanca, Spain, where I am now, there's a nice Roman bridge from the first century AD. I just took a picture and posted it on Twitter, and somehow it caught up. I don't know why. Lebanon sardines and all these weird concoctions I do. So it's not that I strategically kind of branded myself as a bridge dweller. It's just I posted it, and I don't even remember how it caught up, and then I became a bridge dweller. At first, I used to say, oh, it started with a joke. Something along the lines of, this marketplace discussions is an attempt to bridge the gap between disciplines. So I wanted to take philosophy back to marketplace to bridge the gap between disciplines. And the joke was, but I ended up living under that bridge. And I had the picture of that Roman bridge. And so people liked it, and it became kind of my brand.
Love it. So I have to ask you this question, though, before I forget. So have you ever actually slept under a bridge? Like, literally?
I'm not sure. I think I might have slept under a bridge, honestly, because we used to go camping a lot back in Lebanon. So Not that I'm aware of, but I slept in nature like for so many years. If I did sleep under a bridge, it wasn't as nice as this Roman bridge here in Salamanca.
Got it.
And this is why I switched from living under a bridge to dwelling under a bridge.
That's
why I'm a bridge dweller now, because I go there. Today, for example, I spent an hour. I just go there. I listen to an audiobook. I just contemplate. It's really, really nice.
It's nice.
So it caught up. But yeah, now I've also rebranded.
I love the rebrand, by the way. Love the new look. Love the And by the way, I'm glad you said that, because that's part of the whole idea about trying new things. Like, so what? Like, you know, you rebranded into something new. You have to be right only once. Like, this is the idea behind it, right? Like, no one's going to remember things that you've changed. They might, but that might actually be a good thing over time, right? Oh, you remember how it used to be. So, you know, companies do it all the time, and it doesn't hurt for you to try different things as an entrepreneur.
The only difference is now I could spare some cash to hire a professional. So Lama, this is a shout out, Lama Ramadan from Brand And. And she did an amazing job. Like, I didn't even notice the bridge until someone pointed it out in my logo, the MR. But yeah, so
oh, nice.
Thank
good
you
job,
very
Lama.
Much, Lama. You did a really good job. If anyone wants rebranding, you can. I'll link eventually. But yeah, so any final whatever, anything you'd like to say, maybe anything you'd like to share. This was really enjoyable for me, by the way.
Yeah, likewise.
And if it were for me, I would spend like 3 hours, I know, but let's end it here.
We want to give listeners a break. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you for agreeing.
This is one of the more sort of internal exploration type interviews and podcasts I've been on, and I really enjoyed it, because it's like, I sometimes find it hard to talk about myself, and literally, seriously, it felt like therapy. So thank you.
This was nice.
Yeah, yeah, and I love your idea behind bridging different concepts and fields and philosophies on that. And I look forward to connecting more online on Twitter and in the Small Bets community. So I'm just available. Like, I'm on Twitter at author.
Yeah,
on the
tell
side,
us where
on
yeah.
my website. Yeah, if you want to find me, just head over to writerontheside.com. My blog is there. My podcast is there. All my links to Twitter or LinkedIn, if you want to connect there, happy to.